Welcome to 45 North. I'm Ann Strangchamps. Singer-songwriter Josh Ritter is touring the country with a new album, The Beast in Its Tracks. It's a collection of songs that chronicle the end of his marriage, an album full of heartbreak and bitterness and also forgiveness. The best-selling track on the album is this one, Joy to You, Baby.
The cups of who cares go up in the night sky, up in the clouds, fly over the houses, and looking down, joy to the city, joy to the streets, and joy to you, baby, wherever you sleep tonight.
Josh Ritter will be performing in Wisconsin in just a couple of weeks, and he's here with us today with his guitar. And Josh, welcome to 45 North.
Hi, Ann. Thank you very much for having me.
Oh, it's our pleasure. So this song, Joy to You, Baby, is one of the most loving breakup songs I've ever heard. What went on in your life that led you to write it?
Well, you know, I think, this collection of songs is from a period where, you know, beginning with a divorce and ending someplace completely new and better and you know that's the exciting thing about the record, and the thing I'm most proud of is that it took place over a period of time, and by the time I got to the point when I wrote Joy to You, Baby, my life had moved on in a number of really incredible ways. And it became, you know, it became easier to wish the best where before I might have wished the worst.
I would imagine it took a lot of inner work to get there. As a songwriter, you've always been a storyteller. You've written songs about Selkies and outlaws and murdered maidens and early settlers. And, of course, you write fiction also. You published a novel not very long ago, Bride's Passage. So this new album, though, is much more autobiographical, even confessional. I mean, how do you compare it to your other work?
Well, I do. You know, I think that I had always been operated myself with the belief that there is so much more to write about in the world than what, you know, what happens to ourselves in our own lives. If we've got the pen, like, look out the window, you know, it's like there's so much more out there. You know, most of my writing time and my writing life, I feel is sitting there with a cup of coffee and watching the dog, you know, two yards away, you know, and that doesn't make for like a number of exciting songs, you know. So I've always thought, you know, I've taken the idea of being, you know, a song is like a very, very small novel, you know. Mm-hmm. Whether it's a couple crossing the street, or it's an Arctic explorer, or whatever it should be, it could be big or small, but you're still trying to write as wide and full a story as you can in as small a space as possible, and so for that reason, I never thought of a autobiography as being something that I really wanted to do or was that interested in, but then this thing happened to me, which was at the time the biggest thing that had ever happened in my life, and I felt like to not write about it in the way that I felt most comfortable writing would be like going to the Grand Canyon and turning around and you know, writing a song about something completely different. It's like something that had to be written about.
Now, you wrote on your blog that your marriage ended with a phone call. I mean, is that something you'd seen coming? I mean, you'd been married, what, a little over a year?
Yeah, we didn't make it long, but it was a phone call, and it was not one that the circumstances of it weren't any that I maybe had been expecting, although perhaps like in my heart of hearts that maybe I had seen it coming, but there comes a point when just stuff, you know, it's a bridge too far, and for me that moment was a bridge too far, and it had to be the end, and it was not something that I wanted, but it was something that I certainly needed.
Well, I don't know what the predominant feelings were for you. For myself, I can say that when my first marriage ended, and I'm now very happily married, but when my first marriage ended, One of the most difficult emotions for me was the sense of shame. I mean, it was searing. I felt so embarrassed and like such a failure. What was the hardest? What was hardest for you?
I think I felt let down. I felt let down by. I think I felt let down by marriage. You know, I thought like, here's this thing that I had been brought up to believe so fully in. My parents had, most people I knew were, I was in this lucky group of people who seemed to have had been around long, well-working marriages. And so when I went down to the lake and jumped in and gave it a try, I thought the most that could happen is that like you get your courage together and things all work out right in the end. Over time I realized that that wasn't the case. I mean, marriage is I think probably the most dramatic, melodramatic, and courageous and hopeful thing that you can do with your life, and that somebody can do with you. There's so many things in life that come down the pike that are horrible and are debasing and humiliating and lonesome. And if somebody is there with you, and has said that they will be there forever, that's an amazing thing. I think that marriage is an incredible thing. I think that anybody should be able to be married to anybody. Why would we deny anybody that opportunity?
One of the things I really like about this new collection is how completely honest you are about the full range of feelings that come in the wake of a failed relationship. I mean, some are, as you've just been saying, noble. I mean, they're unforgiving, they're hopeful, and unselfish, and then there are others that are also, downright mean. For example, here I want to play a little bit of, we've got queued up the song called New Lover.
Sure.
Sorry, I think that one failed for some reason, but anyway, you actually, maybe this would be a good place. You brought your guitar with you, didn't you?
Should I sing that?
No, I was going to say, I think you brought your guitar with you, didn't you? Is there something
Yes.
Yeah, great. Because our cut didn't fail, but didn't.
Why don't
play,
I sing New Lover?
Sounds great. Thanks.
Awesome. I can't pretend that all is well. It's like I'm haunted by a ghost. There are times I cannot speak a name for the catching in my throat. There are things I will not sing for the sting of sour notes. I feel like a miser. I feel low and mean for accusing you of stealing what I offered you for free. Still it beggars the belief sometimes with thieves we lovers be. I don't know who you're with these days, might be with someone new. And if you are, I hope it treats you like a lover ought to do. But whoever makes you happy, it don't really matter who. I've got a new lover now, I hope you got a lover too. Praise the water under bridges, the time they say will heal. Praise the fonder that still grows on the absent heart and feels. Praise be to this pain these days, it's all I seem to feel. Perhaps the fault was mine, perhaps I just ignored who you were always gonna be. Instead of who I took you for, I've been treated worse, it's true. Still I expected more. But I will not chase your shadow as you go from room to room, dropping handkerchiefs and daggers, smoking guns and other clues for what someone did to someone and who did what with who. I've got a new lover now, I hope you got a lover too. Got a new lover now. She knows just what I need when I wake up in the night. She can read me back my dreams, and she loves them, though she never needs to tell me what they mean.
I got a new lover now. I know that she's not mine, and I only wanna hold her. I don't need to read her mind, and she only looks like you when she's in a certain light. I hope you got a lover now. I hope you got somebody who can give you what you need, like I couldn't seem to do. But if you're sad and you are lonesome, you ain't got nobody true. I'd be lying if I said that didn't make me happy too. I'd be lying if I said that didn't make me happy too.
God, you've got such a gorgeous voice. That's just great to listen to. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I really love that.
You just made my day.
I can hardly be the first person who's told you that. But I love that complex mix of emotions you've got in there, because I think it's such a relief to hear people be honest about how complicated our emotions are. You know, there's like the relief of moving on is in there, but there's also just that little bit of bitterness and spite kind of left in there. And like, that's okay, right?
Yeah. Like, yeah, totally. You know, like I sort of became a connoisseur of these things that people tell you to try and make you feel better. And one of my favorites that I always liked was be good to yourself. I always thought that was like the most infuriating thing. And I was trying real hard. but I think that like there's rare occasions where I feel like in our lives that we have a flat kind of a flashbulb goes off inside ourselves, and we can see the whole map of ourselves, you know, everything about ourselves in that like split second. You know, you can see that thing that is you, that is a collection of so many traits, and you can't help but want to, you know, kind of welcome in the ones that are a little bit less charitable and a little bit less loving sometimes, because they're part of you, and they're kind of you really wouldn't have the comedy of you without these kind of like the more impish kind of evil parts. You know, I think I certainly love that in other people's writing. You know, it's like saying that these parts of us exist.
So I'm sure you must have, you're a huge reader as well as a big writer. Are there things you read, you know, memoirs, books, or movies you saw in the wake of all of this as you were kind of reeling in the aftermath? Are there things that you found really helpful or that really hit home?
Yeah, there was the most sounds contrived, but the most helpful thing and fun thing for me to read during this time, and you know, when I really had the energy and stuff, was like was Macbeth. A bunch, you know. I loved. There was something about it, because there's this, you know, besides the fact that there's these like kind of like, you know, these, you know, a collection of really clueless men. And like kind of wandering around a castle, you know, real thugs, but like also this you know, the sympathy for them. They can't, you know, this man can't sleep. He's completely consumed with something, and then you know this whole strange like difficult marriage that he has, but that he wants things to work out, and then he feels like he's too far to let go. There's so many parts of that are so, the nightmares that he has, you know, there are so many parts of it that were so, meant so much to me at the time, you know.
Were you having nightmares?
I had really horrible nightmares. I had like, and this was not because like, you know, I had ever really been consumed with nightmares. I always think my dreams are pretty like, they're funny, but they're never scary, you know. And like, these were, you know, I'd been having real trouble sleeping, and the doctor had given me medication so that I could try, and those made these the most terrifically frightening things. I mean that I can even think of now. So but all that started to turn into songs, you know, like all those kind of experiences like slowly started to kind of coalesce into a group of ideas that I felt like it was important as my life was starting, was moving and moving forward, that I write them down and try and get them to, as honest as I could. And it was actually much easier to write these songs than I, you know, they were so clear to me. The emotions were so clear, you know, and I felt like if I write these like songs as clearly as possible without changing any emotion in them, you know, then they'll be real, and they'll be actually, you know, down, you know, 30 years from now, I can look back at those songs and know that that's what my life was like at that moment, you know.
Well, you just gave us a perfect cue into Nightmares, which I think this time we do have it queued up. So let's try.
Oh, awesome.
I know where the nightmares sleep. On what butter do they feed? For two long weeks I stayed awake until I saw one cross your face. I knew that you had been untrue. I didn't know how, but I knew that who you spoke to in your dreams was never how you spoke to me now. I'm aware the nightmares.
We're talking with Josh Ritter this hour. He's got a new album out, The Beast in Its Tracks, and he's here to play some songs, and we're playing some songs. I'm Ann Strange Hampson. You are listening to 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Nightmares have their dreams as well. When they sleep, they go to hell. Fill on lakes of blood, can't across the scope pavement.
We're talking with Josh Ritter this hour about his new album, The Beast in Its Tracks. If you would like to join us, the number is 800-642-1234. Maybe there's a Josh Ritter song that has meant a lot to you. You can also email us. The address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And Josh, I'm curious, was writing these songs, you said these were things that you were just kind of writing down really quickly. It was maybe kind of a different songwriting process for you. Was it partly, were you writing songs, you know, the way somebody else might punch a pillow or yell at the walls? Was it your way of channeling or even exercising feelings?
Yeah, you know, initially I think it was, you know, I think that, you know, it wasn't a cathartic thing. I didn't get any release from it, you know. When I was in the first dark days, I was like, you know, like anybody just trying to figure out what was going on, like a little bit like, you know, punched around feeling. But I started writing songs, I think, mostly just to feel like I had some power. But the songs weren't any good. They just didn't feel right. They felt bad. They felt dumb. And so it really wasn't as much of a help to me. It was only until like New Lover kind of came around, that song, where I started to realize that the reason why I didn't like those early songs, you know, while they were songs, they just had no mix of emotions, you know, and they had no, there was no nuance, there was no like secret room in them where you could like find something that was not what you had expected, you know, and that's so once I realized that, then I started to be a little bit more easy with myself about what I allowed myself to write. I wasn't going to write just angry songs. I was going to like write what I was actually feeling, not what I thought should be what I should be feeling. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I was thinking that, you know, divorce is so common in our culture, and yet we're so bad generally at dealing with loss and failure. You know, we kind of treat it as an infectious disease. And on the other hand, that's what we make art out of. I mean, in folk music traditions, at least, you know, all the interesting songs are about loss and failure and sorrow.
Yeah. It's true. Totally.
I don't know. Yeah. Maybe that's what the artist's role is to, I mean, without artists, we'd probably never deal with our darker emotions.
Yeah, there's got to be someone always has to, somebody always has to kind of complain about something, you know? It's usually the artists. We're guilty of it. But I think that's true, you know? But there's always like that moment when, you know, I always think of like a song, like a song can't just be about crossing a street. Like something has to go wrong for there to be a song, you know? For there to be a story at all, something unexpected has to occur. And hopefully it'll be something that people can relate to. You know, I really didn't feel like, you know, these songs I wrote about after a divorce, which, I mean, it comes with a capital D and all that, but I still think that, you know, really thinking about it in a you know, if I think about it like as truthfully as I can, I mean, I think I've had my heart broken this bad 100 times. You know, it happened this way, you know, involved lawyers, but when I was 6 years old, I think on the playground, that heartbreak is still there and still the same, and it's just, you know, describing sorrow is hard, but it's also, you know, from a writing sense, it's really exciting to try and write about it exactly what it is, you know.
Well, write about it and also to a certain extent kind of mythologize it, animate it, because that's what you've done in a lot of songs that have, where there's more of a story, there are other characters, you know, there are, I don't know, killed maidens or outlaws or mythological characters. I mean, write, that's a, I don't know, a tradition that means a great deal to you.
Absolutely. Totally. I love the stories.
Is there one that comes to mind now you might give us?
Sure. How about, I'll do this one from a earlier record. This is called Temptation of Adam.
Oh, great.
If this was the Cold War, we could keep each other warm. I said on the first occasion that I met Marie, we were crawling through the hatch that was the missile silo door, and I don't think that she really thought that much of me. I never had to learn to love her like I learned to love the bomb. She just came along and started to ignore me. But as we waited for the big one, I started singing her my songs. I think she started feeling something for me. We passed the time with crosswords she thought to bring inside. What five letters spell apocalypse, she asked me. I won her over singing W-W-I-I-I. Oh, she smiled, and we both knew that she'd misjudged me. Oh, Marie, it was so easy to fall in love with you. It felt almost like a home of sorts or something. And you would keep the warhead missile silo good as new. And I'd watch you with my thumb above the button. And then one night you found me in my army issue cot. And you told me of your flash of inspiration. You said fusion was the broken heart that's lonely's only thought. And all night long you drove me wild with your equations. Oh, Marie, do you remember all the time we used to take? We'd make our love and then ransack the rations. I think about your leaving now and the avalanche cascade. Eyes get washed away in chain reactions. Oh, Marie, if you would stay, then we could stick pins in the map of all the places where you thought that love would be found. But I would only need one pin to show where my love's at, in a top secret location 300 feet under the ground. Oh, we could hold each other close and stay up every night looking up into the dark like it's the night sky.
Pretend this giant missile is an old oak tree instead. We'd carve our name and hearts into the warhead. Oh, Marie, there's something tells me things just won't work out above. That our love would live a half-life on the surface. So at night while you are sleeping, I hold you closer just because. As our time grows short, I get a little nervous. So I think about the big one, WWIII. Would we ever really care if the world had ended? And you could hold me here forever, like you're holding me tonight. I think about that great big button, and I'm tempted.
Oh, that is really wonderful. You write these songs that are like little short stories.
And which, thanks.
I mean, I realize this is why you count a lot of well-known writers among your fans. Though you're also a fiction writer yourself. Are the stories sometimes too big? I mean, does it sometimes happen you think, no, whoa, that's just too big a story to tell in the song. It doesn't want to fit in there.
Well, that's interesting because I think that, like, I think of songs and like as a song is like a real like you're building a hallway, you know, and you're building a hallway with lots of doors. I mean, when I listen to someone's song, you know, if I listen to a song like a Lucinda Williams song, and I walk down that hallway and the song, and then I go off into my own head, you know, like it kind of gives you this reverie, you know, and some stories, I just want to go a song like. If a song I feel like I'm working on is right, then I want to then I feel like you should be able to go off into anywhere, a new world. But sometimes I want to go myself, and that's why I wrote like Bright's Passage. I felt like the song could be a song, but there was so much back there that I wanted to see. You know, it felt like I wanted it to be bigger.
That was your novel, which is, remind me what it's about.
It's about a man who comes home, kind of a real normal young guy from comes home from the First World War, and he believes that the angel who saved him in France is now living in his horse. And it's about him and his horse,
right.
Like escaping a wildfire.
Oh, that's right. I remember critics loved that novel. It's on my bookshelf. Just haven't gotten to it yet. Are you working on another one?
Yeah, I'm working on one. I'm working away. It's like a big rowdy, terrible language novel set in Northern Idaho.
Sounds like fun. If you are a Josh Ritter fan, we're talking with Josh Ritter about his music and his new album. And if you are a fan of his, maybe there's a song of his that gets you through heartbreak or down times. Call us at 1-800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. I was thinking, you write this great blog, and one of the things that you write about is kind of advice for how to live a creative life. There's a line I really love. You said your advice in terms of making a living doing something you love. I think you wrote, making a living doing something you love isn't only about making a living, it's also about making a life. What did you mean?
Well, I just think that you know, there's so much emphasis placed now on the amount of money you'll make doing anything. You know, I feel it's a disease that will infect you if you take over and change your choices in your life that you make, and it will take away some of the more rich experiences that you can't buy. Part of like having a family and a life around you and a group of people around you is that, you know, that you're passionate about something that gives you the confidence and the joy to go off and be a good person to those other people. You know, if you're not living like a life where you're fulfilled by something, then you're going to be taking from everywhere around you. I think really like letting whatever it is that's in you come out is so important, because other people get something from that, and then when you need something from others, that's, it's not so it feels like a real exchange, you know. I just feel it's really important to like let your freak flag fly, you know.
It's easier said than done, though. I mean, I'm thinking you've had so much success, and you've, at least in your songs, it's clear that you cultivate a lot of positive virtues. I mean, some of my favorites of your songs are the songs that communicate this belief in just the goodness that's around us, kind of everyday beauty. And but I wonder, is there a piece of you, you know, underneath that, that, as is true for a lot of creative people, that's also driven, that also thinks that nothing you've done is good enough, and that you know you're always reaching for the next thing that hopefully will be better?
I think that it's very true that, like, that you know, the trade-off for you know, the only thing you have as an artist, really, I believe, is this belief, and this occasional belief in yourself, and to create something, you know, that has never been created before. You know, that means that it may not be perfect in the eyes of the world, but it is perfect because it's never existed. And the thing that you get from you get this chance to make things that have never been made, and the flip side of that is you have this uneasiness all the time, and quiet dissatisfaction all the time with what you've done, you know, so that nothing is ever right. And I think that's why people put out more than one record, what put out more than one book. And you know, I feel, you know, sometimes I feel like maybe the most I've ever been satisfied, it's been about 10 minutes, you know, after a record is done or something like that. And I feel like I live for those moments, and they go very quickly, and it's on to something new that I want to try. But in my life, I'm certainly much happier than if I wasn't able to get those out.
Yeah. How do you cope with that, though? I mean, after a while, I mean, I suspect I'm a fair amount older than you are. I just think after a while you get to a point in your life when you think, am I ever going to be satisfied?
Yeah, I don't think it ever happens, you know? And I think that there's, you know, other things can, you know, you can be happy in other ways, and you know, I mean, short of hanging it up like Philip Roth, you know, which came out of left field. But like,
don't you sort of feel like there's a part of him that might think, well, oh, wait a minute, I think I have one more novel in me.
Yeah, maybe you can do like a comeback tour or something like that. It'd be awesome.
No, he'll have to publish under a pseudonym.
yeah. It's just. I don't think I'll ever be satisfied. But this is what I love. This is what I love to do. Like it's. There are moments. The moments on stage that are so. They give me. They put years back on my life. You know. And sitting in my room, kind of giggling away when I first had my really catch a song, I've really got something that I think is going to be good. Those are moments that are I wouldn't trade, even if the rest of the time I'm kind of jittery and looking around.
We've got one caller on the line, Cindy from De Pere. Hi, Cindy.
Hi. I was actually, with everything that you've just been saying about life in itself, one song that helps me in all those bad feelings is a James Taylor song called The Secret of Life. Mm. It's one I go to whenever I'm down or I need to remember what's important. Mm.
Okay, thanks.
That's great. That's great.
Josh, what do you listen to? Anything when you're feeling like you need your spirit picked up?
Right now, I'm listening to I'll be honest. I'm listening to the Jay-Z Kanye West Watch the Throne record. That thing is amazing, and it's like, and it's beautifully produced. The lyrics are the best lyrics. Like they're just so good. I'm listening to the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band while The Circle Be Unbroken all the time right now, too.
Mm, that's great.
That's my mixtape. What about you?
Well, right now I'm listening to Josh Ritter, to tell you the truth.
Awesome.
Yeah. So you do so much performing live, and I noticed you've got a lot of dates coming up in Ireland later on, and that's a place must be close to your heart because you go back and perform there and in Scotland. There's a different kind of performing tradition there, isn't there?
I think it's a, you know, there's a, it's a little bit more like a party, like, and I don't mean that in how the audience is or how it's, I mean that like when the show is done, people tend to stick around, you know, people don't immediately go home. Like I've always noticed that and thought that that's really interesting. I've also, you know, like that it, you know, while a show may get bigger, you know, and you know, and you may move to a different venue or whatever, it retains kind of the feeling of being in like a pub somewhere, which is, you know, I the first time I really played to people who were listening was in a place in Ireland called Whelan's, which is a big pub. And I don't think I've ever really left that behind. That was to me like I imprinted on that on that feeling, that vibe, and I think I've always had that with me.
Because I think it's sort of, never having been there, I think, isn't it kind of a tradition of the musicians show up and they play, but if there are people in the audience or visiting musicians coming through town, there's a feeling that music making should be something we do together. It's like a shared conversation rather than a one-way performance.
Oh yeah, that is absolutely true. There is nothing sacred. Just because you're on stage doesn't mean you're on a pedestal. You know, you're like, there is a, you know, you're, it's a conversation. It's often shouted. You know, it's like there's a lot of shouting, which is a lot of fun. You know, people will shout stuff at you immediately.
Or will they shout out, you know, yeah, no, not that chord, dummy?
The number of times that has been shouted at me, actually, you hit the nail on the head. There's like that. It's anything goes, and really, it's, you know, that's the place that I learned really that I think the most important thing about performing and maybe about writing too is you get embarrassed. You're gonna be embarrassed. You know, you're gonna feel like you fell on stage, things will go wrong, things will go unexpected, and you'll be embarrassed and you'll just move on, and that's the only thing that matters is moving on. That's the only thing anybody ever, I think, really wants to see is to continue, you know.
Yeah, I'm so struck by the fact that what I'm listening to a lot is your earlier album. I'm terrible at titles. So Goes the World, So Runs the...
Oh, yeah, So Runs the World.
Yeah,
So Runs
the World. Great title, by the way. So many of those songs seem to me to involve traveling in some way or another.
Yeah.
There are trains, there are ships and maps and places. And I'm struck by how often you've talked about moving on, just keep going. Sort of like, you know, the underlying metaphor for you for much of life is about movement, journeying.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, well, I feel like to be an American in this time is to be able to move wherever you want and go wherever you want. You know, that's an amazing thing.
And it's a deep part of our, I think, of our underlying nature as Americans. We are mobile people. You know, we're people who, many of us, our ancestors came to this country, you know, immigrated in the first place, and then could never sit still. So there's that tension, don't you think, for us between the desire to, the yearning to sit still, and
it's true,
and the nomadic impulse.
I think that that's, yeah. You feel totally, you know, ambivalence between wanting to stick in one spot and wanting to leave, you know. And I always, my father was the first one to leave the little town he grew up in Pennsylvania, the first in 250 years, you know. And I always thought that was cool. My mom's family came from an Oregon Trail family, like, you know, with children that didn't make it on the trail and sod houses in North Dakota, and it always seemed like, you know, it had always seemed like such a they both seemed so romantic, these branches of my family, and had come from the steppes and from Alsace-Lorraine and all these places that seemed so exciting. Maybe I took that with me.
You were just born to be a traveling musician.
yeah.
Josh, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been really great talking with you, and good luck with the tour and the new album.
Thank you so much, Anna. I hope I didn't ramble too much. This was really awesome.
No, it's fantastic, and thank you for playing for us.
Awesome.
Okay. We've been talking with Josh Ritter about his new album, The Beast in the Tracks, and he is touring. And in fact, he'll be in Madison and Milwaukee in a couple of weeks. April 23rd, he plays Milwaukee's Pabst Theater. April 24th, Madison's Capitol Theater. And stay with us. We've got more coming up. I'm Ann Strange Hamps, and this is 45 North on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to the heartbeat of a lark, or a lark in my heartbeat. Hey.
I met Calvin and Hobbes in the paper, I think, the way most people do.
Looking through the comics, and Calvin and Hobbes was always one that stood out.
My grandmother is a huge fan of Calvin and Hobbes.
My first and only crime, I shoplifted this book.
And I found this book of complete Calvin and Hobbes. It was in English, but I said, I don't care. I'm going to learn this language just to understand this book.
Calvin's like the kid you want to be, you know? Even if you're a 300-pound black kid, I mean, you still want to be Calvin.
Joel, start out by telling me something about the origins of the film. Where did you get the idea that you wanted to make a film about the creator of the Calvin and Hobbes comic strip?
It really goes back to childhood. I mean, I loved the strip growing up. And just years later, as cliche as it sounds, it was a shower moment. I just decided that, you know, how is it possible that this comic strip from my childhood still is so important to me, you know, as an adult? And I'm a filmmaker. This is something that I'm passionate about, and that's where it started.
Well, you obviously know Calvin and Hobbes better than a great many of us. Do you have favorite strips?
There's too many to really have a favorite, but there are definitely some that I really love. The Denial strip is one of my favorites.
What's the Denial strip?
It starts out and you see a pterodactyl. It's a Sunday strip. You know, so it's a full half page, and you see a pterodactyl flying peacefully across over the ocean. And the next panel, this water creature jumps out of the water, and there's this, you know, huge bubble that says, "Calvin, pay attention." It's his teacher, Mrs. Wormwood, and she says, "We're studying geography. What state do you live in?" And just Calvin sort of casually replies, "Denial." And, you know, the final panel, she says, Mrs. Wormwood says, "Well, I suppose I can't argue with that." And
that's really great.
It's such a great strip, and to me, it actually is a really good example of what you can do in the comic medium.
So the conundrum about all of this, and this is really what your film is about, is that everybody knows and loves Calvin and Hobbes. Very few people know much of anything about Bill Watterson, the strip's creator. Why is that?
He definitely, there's a mythology that comes along with Watterson, and it's a big part of why this strip still has so much appeal, I think. He really shied away from the press and, you know, the public, and he really valued his privacy.
He also refused to let it be commercialized in the sense that there are no Calvin and Hobbes dolls or stuffed animals. There are no films. There are no Saturday morning cartoons. I'm sure he had offers.
He definitely had offers. And I'm really pleased and grateful that he declined them all. You know, now if you want your Calvin and Hobbes fix, you need to turn to the books. His legacy is cemented that way. Calvin and Hobbes hasn't been watered down. Kids these days won't grow up knowing Calvin as on a Saturday morning cartoon. They'll know of Calvin from the strip, and that's the way I think it should be.
So who is Bill Watterson?
I think of Bill Watterson as a normal guy from small-town America.
Ohio?
Had an interest. Yep, he's from Ohio, from Chagrin Falls, Ohio. And I see him as someone who had a skill that he developed, and he decided at an early age that he wanted to be a cartoonist, and he pursued that with dedication that was difficult. He definitely had some hardships, but then when he did get syndicated after a lot of rejection, he put his mind to making the best comic strip that he could make.
Is he reclusive in a J.D. Salinger kind of way, or does he just not do publicity?
He is commonly referred to as the J.D. Salinger of the comics, and described as a recluse. And I cringe at the word recluse a little bit because I think he is just a guy who doesn't like to be in the spotlight. And I don't think that that's strange. I think that that's pretty normal, really. It's just that he's become such a revered and respected figure that the fact that he doesn't want to be in the spotlight becomes this big part of the mythology.
So you made the decision in making the film not to try to get an interview with him?
We do go to Chagrin Falls, okay. But when we visited Chagrin Falls, Watterson's parents' home was off limits. We set these rules that it wasn't about tracking him down. It was about the impact of the strip.
Did you communicate with him at all? Did you send him an email, say, you know, just want to let you know we'll be doing this?
We know that he was aware, that he became aware of the project at a certain point, but we never did reach out to communicate to him directly.
Do you know if he's seen the film?
We did do our festival premiere in Cleveland, and he does live in the Cleveland area. So we felt it would have been disrespectful to not let him know. So we did extend an invitation to him to attend one of the screens. While he politely declined, we did end up sending a copy of the film to him.
Wow, but for all you know, he could have been in the audience wearing a big hat.
It could be. No one came up to us afterwards saying, hey, I'm Bill Watterson. I liked or did not like your film. I did have nightmares about being punked at one of the screenings, and I'm pleased to say that hasn't happened.
You know, I read somewhere something that stuck with me. The more you love something, the more you try to learn about it or know about it. And the more you learn and know about something, the more you love it. You know, there's this lovely kind of spiral that keeps going. I'm guessing that you must have found your love, your appreciation for Calvin and Hobbes changing, deepening maybe over the course of working on the film.
Yeah, I came in, you know, being a huge fan of Calvin and Hobbes and having a lot of respect for Watterson just because I simply loved what he had done. And then the more I learned about the choices he had made, the more I read articles and interviews with him that came from early on in the run of the strip, I definitely have even more respect than I started with, and even more of an appreciation for Calvin and Hobbes. One of the things that I definitely realized is it seems to me like there was sort of this perfect storm. The way the newspaper comics were at the time, if Calvin and Hobbes hadn't come along at that point in time, we might have never gotten to enjoy it.
Hmm. Well, that's a kind of a sad note running along here, as newspapers have struggled and so many have had to shut down in the last decade. You know, comics and the newspapers are in trouble. You know, you wonder, will another generation get to grow up seeing comic strips in the newspapers every day?
Yeah, I mean, the way that the comics used to reach such a wide audience, and on any given day from November 18th, 1985 until the end of 1995, on any given day across the world, there were people who were opening up their comic sections searching out Calvin and Hobbes. You know, every day, millions of people reading Calvin and Hobbes. The strip disappeared from the newspaper, but we have that decade worth of strips, and I think that the fact that he decided to only run it for those 10 years and then essentially just sort of walk away, I think it raises our appreciation of it. We don't have a place to go find Calvin and Hobbes or like a new strip every day anymore. But, you know, if you keep on just reading your books over and over again, I think it's still very fresh. And I still get plenty of enjoyment out of reading Calvin and Hobbes, even though it's strips that ran years and years ago.
It's Joel Schroeder talking about his new film, Dear Mr. Watterson, showing at the Wisconsin Film Festival this week. Today's show was produced by Marika Saval with help from Rhonda Fanning, technical wizardry from Dave Potrez and Joe Hartke. I'm Ann Strangehamps, and I hope you'll join me again next Friday here on 45 North from Wisconsin Public Radio.
TV and radio stations across Wisconsin will participate in this.